You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Now, each and every one of us is addicted to something, like we're addicted to this radio show, but some of those addictions are benign, some are deadly. In The Forsaken by Matt Rogers, we discover just how deadly. So, Matt, welcome to 3CR.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I lost sight of the body count in this novel, Matt. We've got addicts, we've got CIA operatives, we've got bodyguards. It's an impressive count, huh? Did you tally them up all together?
I do have an exact tally, but not on me. I think it's definitely upwards of 30. It's a full-on novel. It's, I guess a John Wick movie put to the page with hopefully a bit more of a plot and a bit more philosophy.
Well, there's a bit more depth and a bit more layering. Now, I was just talking with you offstage about the opening, but I've had an advanced reading copy, so the opening's changed just a little. But it was very unusual because normally in these sorts of things, we get a death that brings about the action and spurs the hero on. But in this instance, within the first couple of chapters, we have Logan Booth, who basically loses all reason to live. How is that possible?
Yes, and that happens basically before the book starts. So I wanted to kind of have the origin story, I guess, in a way, already in the rear view by the time it kicks off. So we open on Logan Booth, who he is an ex-contract killer who believed that he was working for what was effectively a vigilante organization that was basically cleaning up after America. So cleaning up after the stuff that the government ignores. And then at the tail end of his career, he finds out that he was basically just being manipulated by the CIA the entire time to do their dirty work. So he's in a spiritual crisis, I guess you could call it, when this opens.
Speaking of spiritual, he's a very intriguing man. I mean, philosophically, he's a mixture. He's a sort of ascetic in some ways, a sort of beautiful simplicity. The Japanese call them shokunin, the ones who chase this perfection. Most translate the word to artisan, but that's not quite right. I saw it as a single-minded devotion to endless repetition, meditative repetition. But his repetition is associated with death and murder.
Yes, so the origin story of that is that when I was probably 14 or 15, I watched Jiro Dreams of Sushi for the first time, which is one of the most acclaimed documentaries ever. It's about one of the greatest living sushi chefs in Japan. And that is effectively his philosophy and the philosophy of a lot of the, Japanese craftsmen or artisans. I was writing vigilante thrillers all the way back then, and I thought, why not sort of shift that philosophy over and apply it to an assassin?
But there's a philosophy of a different kind, literature. His operative, his CIA operative, was nicknamed Thoreau. Mm-hmm. But there's a significance to that because it's named after Henry David Thoreau and his novel Walden. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately. Mm-hmm. So he's a very literate man, is Logan.
He is, and that provides a lot of, I guess, the justifications for why he does, well, I guess, what he thought he was doing, which was serving this vigilante organization. Thoreau has an essay called Civil Disobedience, which is from, I think, 1860, where effectively he's saying if you find a law unjust, you don't have to obey that law. That's what Thoreau's argument is, and Logan basically adopts that and winds up a contract killer.
But it's that simplicity of life, following your own individual path, embracing minimalism, all of these sorts of things, which he's taken to heart. But wait, there's more. We've got Greek philosophy. Epictetus, what was his focus?
Yeah, it's all a blend of all of the things that I've found most interesting over the years. You know, I studied philosophy in high school, and we had the launch for this book last month, and my high school philosophy teacher came and bought a copy and got a photo with me. So that was really wholesome. But there's definitely a wide ranging blend of. I wanted to show in this book with the Epictetus stuff that sort of we have kind of the wrong interpretation of Stoicism in the modern day. It's associated with, you know, suppressing emotions and sort of these toxic elements. But effectively, Stoicism is just separating the world into what you can and can't control. And that's what Logan tries to do to mix results.
But you've juxtaposed this literary background, philosophical, spiritualism, and all of these sorts of things against Logan's relentless nature of killing, all for a good cause, of course. It seems a dichotomy in some ways.
It does, and that's why I loved exploring it, and that's what I've always kind of been fascinated by with this genre. It was the first season of True Detective with Matthew McConaughey that first kind of showed me that the commercial audience, I guess, does have an appetite for some really heavy philosophy in a crime or, you know, crime thriller setting. Because, I mean, a thriller's effectively, at the end of the day, it's characters going through the most extreme situations you can possibly imagine. So I've always thought, you know, what better arena to apply philosophy to and to explore some complicated themes.
Now, there are some other characters in this story as well. We've fleshed out Logan, but Logan's seeking to avenge the death of a friend, Jorge, who is a journalist who's discovered a story. He's also protecting Alice, who is an actual addict, in the conventional terms, and she's witnessed the crime, so she needs to be protected. And one of the people responsible is Daniel Datvian, and all of them have a form of addiction, which I think we can flesh out a little. They're all trying to hide something?
They're all trying to hide something in a way. They're all... So Logan and Alice are the two protagonists of this book, and they're both completely broken in their own ways. And I wanted those to be very different ways, and that they can each see what's best for each other, but they can't see what's best for themselves. And then Daniel, who is the villain of this book, is broken in his own completely separate way, where I kind of wanted the villain to be almost the most toxic parts of the self-improvement industry all kind of mashed together, where it's sort of this relentless pursuit of more, which we've seen in a lot of villains throughout the fiction ages. But I wanted kind of a different spin on it, where we have these chapters from Daniel's perspective, and to everyone else in the book, he's this horrifying, menacing presence. And he basically spends the entire course of the book having a steadily escalating breakdown and spiraling internally.
But he's read Nietzsche. I mean, he's read Nietzsche's The Will to Power as an adolescent, and somewhere within its pages, it first struck him that truth is not objective. Truth is irrational. 1 + 1 = 3. If someone with a gun to your head says it is, such a tantalizing idea. So he's hell-bent on power, but what's it masking?
Well, that passage is what I wanted to use to basically sum up Daniel, which is that he is, in his core, just desperate for control of everything, desperate for control of himself, control of everyone around him. And he in this book, we see he does not have control of himself internally whatsoever. I wanted that dichotomy to be there as well between what he's experiencing internally and then what everyone else in the book is experiencing him doing, and almost thinking that he is, you know, this master of reality, but really he's just this sort of scared little boy in his core. Yeah.
That underlying fear within him that's compelling him to behave in that manner. I wonder if we could apply another name to him of a real estate developer in America, but we better not go there.
Well, that was the point, but yes.
But then we've got corruption then at the heart of this. I mean, Daniel's a developer of a kind, and this sets off the investigation that Jorge did and then the consequences that follow.
Yeah.
What's he attempting to do in that regard? What's he...
Well, that's the kind of the twist at the end, so I can't reveal exactly what he's trying to do, but his kind of spiritual journey is that he's kind of running away from, in his chapters, he's running away from the beast, this beast that's lurking within him. And I'm pretty vague on what that is almost until the very end when the plot of the book gets revealed, or the sort of his motivations get revealed. But yeah, it's a, uh, that's why I've set this in New York, because it's kind of this ambitious, corrupt, it's sort of the highest representation of greed and corruption.
Well, we go into this notion of corruption because we have the mayor, Terrion Young.
We do.
How compromised is he by Daniel?
Well, I won't reveal that either, because we'll find out to what extent he's compromised. But I also wanted that to be a major part of Daniel's chapters and the mayor being involved in the book because,
on.
What was I going to say? Oh, so, you know, Terrion is, we don't know to what extent he's sort of the mastermind behind what Logan and Alice are going through. And Daniel's in the book, but it's not really clear to the extent to sort of who's running who and who's controlling who. And that's the corruption that this book explores.
And this is what Logan has to find out. Yeah. Who does he have to dispatch to bring about justice?
Right. Who is he even fighting?
Is it Daniel who's sort of pulling the strings? What is the level of political corruption? Mm. And really, it's a well-known fact, is it? I mean, the degree of political corruption that we see today, and politicians need money to run their campaigns, etc. What compromises are they prepared to make for the money they're going to get?
Well, that's sort of the core of what I wanted to explore in this book, is that so much of the corruption that I sort of delve into and describe is through perfectly legal avenues and through, you know, it's a lot of it is by the book.
Yeah, well, a lot of these politicians are very close to the edge in terms of the level of corruption. Mm. Terrion at one stage is wanting to perhaps admit to, because he can't face the pressure of what he's under.
Mm.
But we also then have another character in the background, Jacinta, who's got a hell of a lot of firepower at her disposal. And that sort of is a very intriguing sort of thread to follow in terms of what power she can bring to bear and who she actually is, which we can't tell anybody.
Yeah, that's probably the number one thing I can't reveal. You should be able to connect the dots, maybe, if I've led all the way to the top. But yes.
Well, it's intriguing to see the CIA are involved. Mm-hmm. You know, there are all sorts of characters like that. So all of this brings us back to sort of Logan's total disillusionment in the first place and the killing machine that he has become in order to set things right. So we're basically out of time at this stage. The book is The Forsaken. The author is Matt Rogers. One of many? There's a series coming out of this?
This is my traditional publishing debut. I've been self-publishing for 10 years before this, so I've got sort of nearly 30 novels self-published by this point. But yeah, this is my first with a traditional publisher. It'll be a 3-book series, and yeah, I hope it provides a little bit more depth than your typical kind of action thriller.
And the publisher is Simon and Schuster. So, Lisa.
Fantastic. Thank you, David. Thank you. Today, I'm so excited because I have Jane Tuttle with me, and I just read her new memoir called The Sea in the Metro, which I absolutely adored. Jane is a celebrated memoirist and a performer whose creative life spans Australia and France. She's a graduate of the school I went to, in fact, which is the Jacques Lecoq School in Paris. She has woven a multifaceted career through theatre, translation, writing, and the running of a bookshop in Queenscliff. Welcome, Jane.
Thanks so much, Lisa. I'm so happy to be here.
The Sea in the Metro charts the emotional terrain of early motherhood in Paris, balancing a child, marriage, art world hunger, while feeling increasingly disconnected from both the city you once adored and your own sense of self. Did you ever consider fictionalising parts of this book, or was it always going to be a memoir?
Well, that's such a great question right out of the right out of the gates. I never really intended to write. I mean, I didn't intend to write at all, to be honest. Like you, Lisa, I went to theatre school. It's amazing that we went to the same theatre school. I'm intrigued about that. I want to ask you 1,000 questions. I never intended to write memoir. I never intended to write fiction. I basically came out of theatre school and, you know, through these different experiences I've had with a body of notes and text that I wanted to theatricalize, if that's a word. I knew that they were big stories that required a length of time to dig into. If they were films, I would have made them into films. If they were theatre shows, I would have made them into theatre shows. But they really lent themselves to being books. So I didn't set out to write a memoir. I set out to write the stories. Mm. And a bit like at Lecoq, you would remember, Lisa, you know, we spent all this time observing the world around us, and to come back into the grande salle and simply repeat what we'd seen outside wasn't enough. We had to bring what was the true, look for the, what was true inside of that experience and what we saw and make it juiced. So to simply retell wasn't enough. And I think that these books, they're not, I never really even, to be honest, see them as memoirs. They're true stories that have been brought back into the theatre and made and retold. Mm. So they're very loose, you know, they're very much true stories, which is why they've ended up on the biography shelf or the nonfiction shelf or the memoir shelf. The closest thing you could relate it to is memoir, and that's why they've ended up as memoir. But they're, you know, I have told the story in as truthfully, in as truthful a way as I possibly can, and, you know, that's meant all kinds of explorations into how to do that. Mm. It's not a traditional memoir in like, this is what happened to me here, you know, moment after moment. It's not Shane Warne's diary. Do you know what I mean? I find it a strange, you know, it sits on the shelves in those strange places, like other authors. The authors that I love the best are all in this strange place between, I suppose, memoir and fiction.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you touched on the reasoning behind the title, The Sea in the Metro, and tell us that story. So in at Lecoq, it was at Lecoq that actually said, you're finding the world inside your art, that sort of thing. And the line, you should tell this bit, shouldn't you? Tell us about the story behind the title of your book.
Yeah, I actually thought that it was Lecoq that had said, un acteur devrait voir la mer dans le métro. Yeah. And I had written it down in my notes in first year when we were studying The Neutral Mask. And it's something that repeats throughout the three books, actually, Paris or Die, My Sweet Guillotine, and The Sea in the Metro. And it was something that, it was very early on in the theatre school, and it really stuck in my head. What does this mean? Mm. An actor should be able to see the sea in the metro. And I remember being in the metro and trying to see the sea. And I think in Paris or Die, I describe, like, I see nothing but bodies and flesh and the smell of piss. And, you know, I always wondered what that meant. And then in when I started writing this book, it struck me that la mer, the mother, and the sea, they sound the same in French. And I started thinking about that idea that I had lodged in my head, and what is a mother in the metro? What is the sea in the metro? And started to understand that I suppose it's about being an artist and, you know, it not being enough to... I know that Paola, one of our mutual teachers, used to say, it's not enough to act like you see the sea. You have to be the sea. You have to embody the sea in order to truly communicate that to an audience, you know, which is why the training there is so rigorous, because you are trying to find a way to actually find the truth of what the sea represents. And then it was funny. It was actually went on a hilarious journey with the idea, because I thought it was Lecoq. And so I started to ask all my other student friends and other teachers, you know, where, look, I looked through all his books. I asked AI, where is the sea in the metro? And AI is telling me, oh, it was Jacques Lecoq that said that. And in the end, I realized it wasn't Jacques Lecoq at all. It was actually Jinwoo Yoo, the Korean movement teacher that I had at the school who had said that. And in fact, even now in Korea, in his teaching, he uses that idea in his very first classes.
Wow.
A comedian, an actor, a comedian, you must be able to see the sea in the metro. So I suppose for the book, it's about so many things. It accompanied me. It wasn't the first title that I had for the book. In fact, the three books have sort of been loosely based on Dante. This book was always called Paradise or Paradise City or something to do with that. But the sea in the metro was something that came up in a chapter and it started to open out. And, you know, my books are really searches in lots of ways. So I never really found I can't give you a nice little neat soundbite.
Well,
it's a search.
Yes. I loved your memoir is praised for its emotional frankness. And I really connected with the emotional frankness throughout the whole novel. And I think in a way, you know, Lecoq training kind of strips us back for, you know, whatever piece of artwork it is, you're embodying, you know, whatever it is. And it can be, it doesn't matter, it's the same thing. It's just in a different form. You know, it's a dance or it's a book or it's a song or whatever. Did you feel that this was sort of a catharsis in a way, this kind of noting down of all of these events and just as they formed? Was this, and I guess it's just the what you had available, your writing was, it became your you know, the sea in the metro for you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's more of a disease. Do you feel that? I think that being at Lecoq, the best thing I learned was that observation, was actually that, opening up of the eyes. Like I remember in the first year, we had to choose something that we would go and embed ourselves in and follow in order to come back and create a theatre piece. And I remember for us, we followed the street sweepers, the Les Éboueurs de Paris. So we like went and followed, we got up at 5 a.m. and went out and went with the street cleaners. And, you know,
Those times too. Yeah. And I think of visit and yeah.
Okay, you did the zoo?
I can't remember what ours was, but I think it was something industrial as well.
Wow.
We went to factories in the middle of the, you know, like early morning or something.
Someone did meat, I remember. They went with the butchers at Rangis and like watched them all like, and made this amazing piece.
Oh.
But I think that observation, like I know Helen Garner always talks about, it's like a disease in a way. Once you start, you can't stop.
You can't unsee.
Like you actually, you're in a conversation and you just want to write it down so far, you know. So I've got this collection of notes and I love working with, collecting elements of truth and then seeing what I can create with those.
Yeah, so the Parisian atmosphere really shines throughout your work. And it's an influence, it influences your narrative voice and it creates this sort of sense of longing within the text as well. Could you unpack that sort of tension that you have with Paris in that sense? How it felt in real time and how it kind of reflects your creative world. I think there was a quote actually from George Bernard Shaw. You said, "I want to be thoroughly used up when I die." And this sort of theme echoes throughout. So how does Paris relate to this sort of quote, this notion?
Yeah, actually, I remember, I think I wrote in this book, I really don't see Paris as a place a lot of the time. I see it as like some kind of plane in my mind. It's so it's so dreamlike for me in many ways because when I first arrived to go to the Lecoq school, I was freshly grieving the death of my mother. And so I was already in a place where my eyes were very changed. I'd sort of died in a way. I was really, it was almost like a rebirth. And so I think that standing at the top of the Rue du Faubourg-Saint-Denis that first time, this, you know, crazy smashing together of so many different cultures and, you know, ways of living, I felt like I entered into this kind of dreamscape. And Paris has always been that. I've just returned, actually, from a month over there with my family. And it's like a new world as my daughter grows now into being an adult and seeing it through her eyes. And, you know, my Paris is a very I know often when I'm talking in the bookshop about Paris with bookshoppers, you know, the picture that you have in your mind of what Paris means, you know, the sort of the nice shops and the fancy, you know, cakes and things like that. It's not at all the Paris that I think of when I'm writing. And it's a sort of weird, magical plane. Not to sound so too woo-woo, but it's a funny, odd...
It's full of chaos, isn't it? It's wonderful chaos in that sense, especially the street Faubourg Saint-Denis where we went to the school. It's full of life, and you describe that in your book. You cover that. There's a scene where you talk about someone on a motorbike and someone else kissing and all of the stuff that goes on in this street. It's just like a whole massive collection of stuff.
It's a garden of earthly delights, isn't
yes,
it? It's
like yes, this, it is.
You know, you've got the hellscape, you've got the paradise, you've got the
everything
bodies.
Goes in this street. It's
noise.
Amazing. Now, the motherhood component to the work also I'd like to talk about. I think I got this sense in the book that, you know, as an artist, you come to motherhood with sort of more to lose or something else to lose, and it's very different to your male partner. And you articulate this so well when you talk about losing your maleness in the book. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I remember this real shock when I was pregnant. I almost lost the baby early on, so I had to do that thing where you had to cross your legs. I had a lot of time at that point to reflect on what was happening to me. And I remember this really shocking realization that, oh God, I'm not a man. And I think my whole life in lots of ways, I've just been really a boy. You know, I've had the great opportunity of being able to do the things that boys have done. And my partner and I have a very gender neutral relationship. We're not, so I think it was a real shock to me to learn that, oh God, I am going to be doing a woman thing that there's no arguing with it. And I found that deeply shocking. And that's something that I struggle with throughout the book, how to calibrate that, you know, artistic desire and that thrust that I always felt and control over my own being that I'd fought really hard for and drawn on the history of all the fight that had gone on before me, my ancestors and, you know. So it was a big... change in dynamic there.
And that really comes across, that sort of struggle that you had in that, because I completely related to that. Do we have time, David, to just like have a little bit of a... No, we can't. Well,
we've got about a minute and a half left. We've got a bit of change
okay.
over it. Yeah.
In that case, we won't read out a little bit, but I'll just keep asking another question, which is really about modern womanhood. And the book explores modern womanhood with brutal clarity, I thought. And what do you hope especially female readers take away about sort of ambition, identity, and the many ways to belong?
I really wanted to explore through my friendships and through the sort of thinking about my mother's experience, her mother, and thinking about my daughter as she grows up. I really wanted to... celebrate the different ways that we can be women, and that having a child, we never talk about the fact that we don't have to, you know, actually, there are ways that we can claim our womanhood without having to become a mother. And I wanted to not make an excuse for that.
So this wonderful work is called The Sea in the Metro. It's by Jane Tuttle, and the publisher is Hardy Grant. Thank you so much for being my guest today, Jane.
Thank you.
And I was talking to Matt Rogers about The Forsaken from Simon & Schuster. We better get out of here, Lisa.